Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this September 10, Tuesday, the Syrian refugee crisis. The focus of the first hour of our program today, over 4.25 million people have been displaced internally and over 2 million have left the country to seek refuge in Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. Over half are children. This is described as the world's worst refugee crisis since Rwanda's 1994 genocide. We're going to be talking about all the people who have been displaced and how perhaps the world hasn't paid very much attention to these people until recently. We'll welcome your phone calls. We'll have two guests with us during the course of the hour. We'll speak with an Istanbul-based journalist and a little bit later, the senior policy advocate for CARE USA, a leading humanitarian organization that has been fighting the root causes of poverty. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-486-8655. And you can also leave a message on email, talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page where we like to read your messages as well, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We start with Justin Vella. Justin is an Istanbul-based journalist, and as we said, some of the many refugees have been going to Turkey, also Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt. Germany said they would accept some refugees today, and there may be a point where the USA will do the same. Justin, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We have heard this described as the world's worst refugee crisis since 1994, and yet I don't think we've paid very much attention to this. There are so many people who are really in dire straits, and this has been going on for a long time. Why haven't we noticed this more carefully?
You know, I think that it's just is gradually built up over the past 2 years. There was a first several thousand refugees going to Lebanon and Turkey, and as the conflict built, more and more people fled the country. But it didn't happen all at once. Syria is best described, I think, as a slow-motion civil war that has gradually spread out into the surrounding countries. So I think that's why we haven't really focused on it in the way that we might have should have.
Does Turkey have a number of Syrian refugees?
Turkey has about 500,000 refugees at the moment. Only about half of those are in 20 government-sponsored camps along the border area. The rest are living either in rented houses or staying with friends or relatives in the border area, and also in cities like Istanbul and some of the other major cities in Turkey. This is a pretty large number of people, and
yes,
Turkey at the moment is really struggling to support them.
You have to have food for everybody. You have to have some form of employment for everybody, right?
Right. Turkey has spent about $2 million so far on the Syrian refugees, they say. And they're saying that they're running out of resources actually to deal with them. I think that Turkey never really thought that the civil war in Syria would go on for so long. They thought Assad would fall quickly, similar to how Gaddafi fell quickly in Libya. Unfortunately, that's not happening. And what Turkey suddenly has on its hands is a huge population that is largely jobless, young, and kind of aimless and looking for something to do. Many of them go back to fight, but this actually increases the instability along Turkey's borders.
We're going to be focusing on Jordan a little bit later in this hour, but one of the problems there is a number of the children have been unable to go to school because they're helping to bring food home to the family. They're working. Is that the same case in Turkey, or are children there going to school, the refugees?
In the refugee camps that Turkey has set up, and like I said before, there's about 20 of them, there are some schools, and international organizations have helped to establish some schools along the border area. But the problem in Turkey is that the government-sponsored schools are actually taught in Turkish. There's not enough schools that are catering to students that speak only Arabic. So there's not very many Syrian children that are going to school in Turkey either, unfortunately.
So what do they do all day?
There's not much that they can do, really. The Turkish government kind of keeps a closer eye on on children than might be happening in Jordan. And for Turkey, it would be a major public relations disaster if it was discovered that, you know, underage children were working in the country. So I don't think that there's very many children working. You might have some cases of kids working in fields, for example, harvesting fruit and things like that. But for the most part, they're really bored and mm-hmm. just having to sit there. And I think that one just very disturbing thing is that more and more teenagers, you know, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, are starting to go back and fight in Syria as their fathers and perhaps older brothers have done before them. Perhaps their relatives have died fighting in Syria, and they're going to go and continue the fight for them.
Are many of the refugees women and children because their husbands are fighting in Syria or perhaps have died?
Yes, I think the majority of the refugees are definitely women and children. A lot of the men might have initially come out of the country with them, perhaps settling in the refugee camps or helping them get set up in some kind of living accommodation, living situation in Turkey, but then decided to go back and fight or participate in the war effort against the regime in another way. And either they've stayed and you know, continued to fight in Syria, or many times they die as the war goes on.
And do you know the stories? You've probably talked to many people who are refugees. Why have they left Syria? Is there a theme, common theme?
Yeah, I mean, most of them just are scared for their lives, really. Over the course of the past 2 years, you've seen the Syrian regime conduct a campaign of indiscriminate bombing, shelling. And as we saw last month in Damascus, it looks like the regime has started to use more chemical weapons. So most of these people are really just scared. And then also some of them maybe wanted to stay in Syria, but couldn't find work or they couldn't find food along with the safety aspect as well. So they realized that they had to leave the country. But I say that just, you know, fear of losing their lives is the main thing that drives them away.
Do you see a strong international humanitarian presence in Turkey at those camps?
No, and this goes back to Turkey thinking that the regime in Damascus would fall quickly. Turkey is a country that it very closely guards its sovereignty and doesn't allow in foreign organizations very easily. Mm. So at the beginning of the crisis, they thought this is not going to take very long. The refugees are going to be here for maybe a year, a couple months, something like that. We can handle them. But when the regime didn't fall quickly and the refugee numbers increased, Turkey began to realize that it needed help. But because of the kind of laws that exist, it's not very easy for international organizations to come into the country and legally register to work there, to bring in mass shipments of food and medicine. Everything that's being brought in is being done in a quite kind of like haphazard way, in personal luggage, for example. So there's not a huge presence along the Turkey-Syria border of international aid organizations, certainly not the kind of presence that's needed to match the kind of catastrophe we have on our hands.
And Justin, as the Turkish people thought and the government that this would be a short-lived thing, so also the refugees, did they think they would be going home fairly soon?
Yes. I mean, many of them really thought that this was going to be a temporary thing. And some have, I first went to this area and, you know, met with refugees in June 2011. And many of them were thinking, we're just going to stay along the border. We're going to be there for a few months. During lulls in the fighting, they actually went back for some time to their homes. And then the war intensified, and they came back to Turkey. And that's when I think it was by the end of 2011 that some of them really began to think that this is going to take a long time. And you started to see, two things happen. Some refugees settled more in the camps or settled more in Turkey, began to try to look for jobs or start, some kind of new life in Turkey. And then you saw many other people, mostly the men, begin to take up arms, begin to go back to Syria to fight. The refugee camps became organizing grounds for what has become, what is generally described as the Free Syrian Army, the rebels who are now fighting the regime. At first I think that they definitely didn't think that they would have to wait so long in Turkey. But then they realized it was going to be a long war. Mm-hmm. And decided to do what they had to do.
We're having a hard time understanding who the members of that Free Syrian Army are, how many would be our friends and how many might do us ill. Do you have a better understanding of that?
I wish I could say that I do, but I have to say it's in many ways not clear. And I think it's not clear because there's not one set answer that I or anyone can really give the American people about who these rebels are. My personal interaction with these fighters I've never felt threatened as a Western reporter by the rebels, or at least very rarely. I first met the Free Syrian Army in about the end of 2011. These were farmers and just local guys from small towns in the rural northwest of Syria who were fighting in a small village. They were based in a house along the side of a hill.
And I think that's probably all we'll be able to hear because the phone is starting to disintegrate. Thank you very much, Justin, for your perspective on this. Justin Vella is an Istanbul-based journalist and first visited the refugee camps, as you heard him say, in June of 2011. There are now 20 government camps. A number of refugees have found apartments to live in and are trying to work their way into the Turkish economy. There is word today that Germany is accepting several hundred thousand refugees from Syria. Is that the answer rather than these camps? We are going to continue our conversation. We thank Justin for being with us. Blake Zelzer is senior policy advocate for CARE USA, a leading humanitarian organization fighting the root causes of poverty. And they have helped a number of refugees. They did a pretty thorough analysis of what's going on in Jordan, where there are a number of Syrian refugees, and it's not a good situation. We'll be talking about that and the lack of access to school, children working to support their families, problems with feeling safe, women feeling safe in these camps. They are vulnerable without their husbands being there. And there's a lack of fresh water, food, etc. We'll look at the humanitarian international response to this crisis more fully with Blake. And welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This has been described as the world's worst refugee crisis since Rwanda's 1994 genocide. And yet we haven't paid very much attention to it. So let's pay attention, get questions answered, and try to come to a determination of what would help these millions of people. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the refugee crisis now, Syrian refugee, and welcoming calls from you if you would like to join us. We'd like to hear from you this hour, 800-486-8655. Blake Zelzer is senior policy advocate for CARE USA. CARE is a leading humanitarian organization fighting the root causes of poverty. They work all over the world, and they have done a very interesting report on Syria, Syrian refugees in urban Jordan. So we'll be looking at Jordan as well as refugees in other countries. Blake, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Let me ask you the same question. When you look at how huge this refugee crisis is, I'm just wondering about the amount of attention it has received and the amount of aid from humanitarian organizations. Are we woefully lacking in both regards?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, the amount of attention, I think, is increasing, thankfully, in recent weeks and months, due to the increased conflict and increased refugees that we're seeing in the region. And you talked earlier, you know, about some of the other issues that are gaining attention in Congress, looking at the chemical weapons strike and other issues. But I think it's really important to bring it back to the faces of the people that are suffering from this crisis and this civil war in Syria. And to your question on numbers, you know, this is, to put it in scale, there are nearly 7 million people in need of humanitarian assistance.
Wow.
Assistance in Syria and surrounding countries. And so when you're looking at that, you know, that's a huge number. Now, there's been a UN appeal of $4 billion plus. One thing to keep in mind, the United States has actually provided over $1 billion of that appeal. So we have provided a significant amount of funding to the UN appeal, but that number is only going to go up. And so I think the needs will far exceed the amount of money that's available. And overall, the UN appeal, while the U.S. has met its criteria, it still has not been met by the world community. And so there's plenty of need, and that need is likely only to increase.
We were hearing news today that Germany is taking several hundred thousand refugees, and they will be moving into Germany. Is that an answer? Do other countries need to do the same?
That's a good question. I mean, I think other countries, you know, are doing what they can. For instance, CARE is working in countries around Syria. Examples are we work in Jordan and in Lebanon. Those are two examples of places we work. And those countries and governments have been very generous in taking refugees from the crisis. To put an example, looking at Jordan, they have taken upwards of for the refugees, over 500,000 Syrian refugees they've taken in Jordan. And to give it some perspective, that's increased their population about 8%. So if that were to happen in the U.S., it'd be like adding 25 million Syrian refugees to the United States. So countries such as Jordan and Lebanon and other places we're working are taking in a lot of these refugees, but it's putting a strain on their own local economies, which is understandable. And ideally, we want an end to this conflict so these families can go back to Syria and can restore their livelihoods.
Your country director in Jordan was talking very much from the heart about children missing out on their right to an education, not being able to escape a life of poverty. When you look at Syrian refugees in Jordan, there are a huge number of young children who aren't in school, right?
That's right, and that's one of the biggest challenges. The majority of refugees in Jordan that have been fleeing the Syrian crisis are women and children. And so, you know, when they were in Syria, they were going to school and getting that education. But now that the crisis is protracted, it's, you know, up on 2 years now, a lot of them are missing out on a desperately needed education. And the longer this goes on, the more problematic that will be. We are trying to address that as much as we can. A lot of the humanitarian NGOs do that, and the Jordanian government is trying to accommodate as many as they can, but they can't accommodate all of the Syrian refugee children. And so there are some schools in the camps. We're trying to work with schools in urban communities. But the reality is the need for education for these children will exceed what these host governments are able to provide. And that's problematic as the crisis remains protracted.
So if you're in a camp, if you're a refugee, and most women are not working, how do you live? How do you eat?
That's a good question. A lot of the ability to live and eat in these camps is done from humanitarian assistance. So places like, organizations like the World Food Program provides food for these refugees. But one of the issues that's problematic, of course, as you mentioned, is they can't work. And so it not only affects their livelihoods, but you're looking at the long-term consequences of this. It's very troublesome. And so there are understandably rules, for instance, for Syrian refugees. They can't work in Jordan, for example. So how do they increase, you know, continue their livelihoods other than receiving handouts, unfortunately? And it's not a long-term solution to the problem. And so, you know, we're looking for both providing emergency humanitarian relief, but also trying to support livelihoods in the longer term. And the way that needs to happen is for the conflict to end and for these refugees to be able to go back to their country and back to their livelihoods that they had before the conflict.
So what are you asking for from the international community in terms of aid?
Well, a couple of things. One is just an increase of humanitarian aid. And I think, as I mentioned before, while the U.S. has provided a significant amount of the U.N. appeal, the world community still needs to provide more. And I think there are other supports that that Americans can do as well. For instance, the U.S. government is one component of providing support and aid to the Syrian refugee crisis, but there's a lot of wonderful humanitarian organizations that we partner with as well. So CARE, Mercy Corps, other groups that we work with are providing wonderful work on the ground. And even our own organization, you know, we've estimated that we're going to provide $50 million to address the crisis, but even our own programs are only a quarter funded. So I think the American public can both support the United States government through its voice and through their representatives, congressmen and senators, but also through supporting some of the charitable NGOs and calling for an end to the crisis, and so these folks can go back to their livelihoods.
What about other countries? Has Britain given money, France, Russia, China?
All countries have given money. I'd have to look at the charts on how far they are in terms of their pledges to their appeals. But all those countries have definitely given both money, and a lot of the NGOs are based in those countries that you just mentioned. We partner with many British and French NGOs. As a matter of fact, our work in Lebanon is done through French partners.
Hmm. And does anybody, it may be very difficult because there's a civil war going on and it has been for some time, but I'm thinking about the huge number of people, millions, who have been internally displaced in Syria. They must be having pretty rough go here too, aren't they? Do we know what their situation is?
You're exactly correct. If you look at the 7 million people in need of humanitarian assistance, that includes the majority, estimated at about 4 million, to be internally displaced people in Syria. So that's right. And it's really difficult with the civil war ongoing. So CARE, along with many other humanitarian organizations, is working with partners in Syria. But also we're also calling upon the unfettered access for humanitarian aid to be allowed to get into Syria. That's been problematic in not just Syria, but countries around the world in times of a war and crisis, that one of the things the humanitarian groups call for first and foremost is to facilitate the delivery of that humanitarian assistance and protect civilians.
Right. And do we know how much of that is getting into the country?
That's a good question. A lot of that, so there is aid getting into the country, but it's not meeting the needs. And some of that information is somewhat sensitive in terms of working inside Syria, but without question, there's a lot of aid getting in, but it's problematic to get some of it in there, and groups like World Food Program and others are doing incredible work to get into that under very tough circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what the situation is at the camps in Jordan, Blake.
CARE, we work primarily with urban non-camp refugees in Jordan. But we also partner by providing referrals to individuals to the camp. There's a big camp called Zaatari in Jordan now. And to show you the size of the camp, it's quite big. It's along the Syrian border, and it's already the fourth largest city and has a population of over 120,000 people. And so within that camp, you have all kinds of things. And CARE just had a trip. We took a member of Congress, one from California, as well as some other individuals, to see the refugees from the Syrian crisis. And they went to that camp as well as looked at the urban refugees. But within the camp, they provide different services, whether it's healthcare, psychosocial services, education, and food, the basic necessities. But CARE is working a lot with what are known as the urban refugees. And people don't realize, but the majority of refugees in Jordan are non-camp, actually. And so they're within the urban communities within Jordan. And so we are working, setting up referral systems for those urban refugees and providing them referrals to places like Save the Children to provide education, or World Food Program to provide food, or giving them vouchers so they can buy food or pay their rents, that they've secured housing within Jordan. And that's very difficult, of course.
So how have they secured housing?
Well, it's tough. I mean, so one of the things that's happened is some of the Syrian refugees are fortunate enough to have relatives or friends that are in Jordan that can stay with them. But one of the images that's in my mind from a recent care trip that I saw that my colleagues took was, you know, these cramped apartments where they have families of 12 people living in one-bedroom apartments. And so they can provide, you know, care. We do give cash vouchers that can be used for rent, so that's one example. But clearly, it's an unsustainable situation with these families, large families, many of them crammed in with either family members or renting through the open market. But that's also difficult because, as I mentioned earlier, the refugees aren't allowed to legally work in Jordan. And so getting that money to pay the rent or provide for their families is quite difficult.
And they must be quite discouraged because I would imagine many of them have been there for a long time.
Yes, and that's one of the biggest tragedies of this, that's correct, is the previous journalist was mentioning that Justin talked about, you know, a lot of these folks thought, well, this won't go on too long, we'll be able to go back to Syria. That unfortunately hasn't been the case. And so as the crisis goes on and the conflict is protracted, that becomes more and more problematic. And that gets to another priority for care. We look at both providing immediate humanitarian aid, but we also look at providing assistance towards longer-term livelihoods, so these individuals won't have to rely on humanitarian aid. Of course, that's problematic if they can't legally work in Jordan. It begs the question how long they're going to be forced to remain there or other neighboring countries before they can return back to Syria.
Blake Zelzer, our guest this part of the show, senior policy analyst advocate for CARE USA, and they are doing work in Jordan with Syrian refugees at urban non-camp people who are in Jordan, and we're looking at the Syrian refugee crisis this hour of the program. Welcoming your phone calls, this is a huge number of people who are living hand-to-mouth. In some cases, they can't work because their host countries won't allow work permits. So what happens to all these people over a long period of time? You almost wish that people who make war could spend a year living in one of these camps because it's so obvious that this is what happens this is when you have horrors in the world. Huge, huge refugee crisis. How is the world responding? What do you think? Do you have questions about what countries are doing or thoughts about whether or not places like the United States should immediately take in a whole lot of Syrian refugees in other countries in the world? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, you can leave a message that way as well, is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We have an email, Blake, from Eliza, who asks, we know wealthy Qatar and Saudi Arabia are giving money for weapons. Are they contributing money proportionately to the refugee issue?
Yeah, those countries are committing substantial resources to the refugee and humanitarian issue as well. And that gets to my earlier point about the UN appeal of $4 billion, which is very likely to go even higher. It'll take the response and support from not only the Gulf countries and Western European countries and the United States, but everyone around the world joining together in funding this humanitarian crisis. And while a lot of the action in Congress has been focused on a lot of the military strike issue right now, that I think we need to bring the focus back to this humanitarian crisis, because regardless of one's position on the authorization for that military strike, the humanitarian crisis is something that's a dire need, and the international community needs to respond, and they have, and that number is only going to go up.
Yes. Let's go to Jonathan in Toma. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. How are you?
I'm good. So I'm kind of curious as to know if I wanted to give my own time and go to work for maybe CARE or some other type of humanitarian effort, how would I go about doing that?
That's a good question. I think the best thing to do is to go to different websites from some of the organizations. I mean, I know that, for instance, CARE, we have both staff in the region, in the surrounding countries in Jordan and in Lebanon and other places, and as well as many humanitarian organizations based in the U.S. as well as around the world. One place to look that's kind of an umbrella website for humanitarian organizations is called Interaction. That's Interaction. That's an umbrella group of many humanitarian organizations, and that might be a good place to start to get the names and organizations of humanitarian NGOs that are working in the region. And then there are also, I imagine, volunteer opportunities for some of the U.S. government programs as well, but you'd have to check with them. I know USAID has very substantial information on its webpage in terms of the good work that they're doing to help the Syrian refugee crisis as well.
Thank you, Jonathan, for your call. Do you think that the United States should open its arms and say, we're going to take in 500,000 of these refugees?
That's a good question. I mean, CARE doesn't really take a position on that issue per se. I think that, ideally we'd like to see a diplomatic and negotiated solution to this and a lasting peace, so that wouldn't be necessary. But I think as time goes on, that may be something that the U.S. and others around the world are going to need to consider. The U.S. has been very generous in having refugees from all around the world, and we have a strong diaspora in our country that I think only helps benefit our country and our nation in terms of increasing the awareness of the other and having more tolerance, I would say, to people that aren't necessarily like you. But I think that does remain to be seen. Obviously, the economic situation in the U.S. is difficult as well, but I think that is something that, I'm sure will be considered. And I think as a nation, we're better off the more diverse we are.
Blake Zelzer, our guest, and he is senior policy advocate for CARE USA, a leading humanitarian organization fighting root causes of poverty. It was founded in 1945, and we're talking about Syrian refugees. Their special area is urban Jordan, where they have done a great deal of work. We hear about the camps, but there are people who are living, 12 to a small apartment, and no work because you can't work in Jordan. So the housing is not good and water supplies are not good and food is hard to come by. So how is the world responding to this huge humanitarian crisis, which has been described as the world's worst since Rwanda's 1994 genocide? Here's our phone number if you'd like to join our conversation with Blake, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. How should the world be responding to this humanitarian crisis? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Blake Zelzer is our guest now. He's a senior policy advocate for CARE, a leading humanitarian organization fighting the root causes of poverty in this country and also around the world. 800-486-8655. Brian in Lancaster, hi.
Hi. I think it's a great show. I just had an idea that maybe this could be a real opportunity for the international community in particular, perhaps a country that is not normally considered an ally or a friendly nation to the Syrians. Would there be a possibility that maybe Israel could open their doors to invite some of these refugees in with the support, financial and otherwise, of NGOs and other countries? To establish I don't want to call it a camp, maybe, but something that would be less unpleasant for the refugees, and that would perhaps even turn a lot of hearts in the Syrians themselves to seeing Israel in a different light.
Blake?
Yeah. I think, well, first, CARE doesn't, we don't work in Israel. We work in areas where there's different countries focused on extreme poverty. But I would say it's pretty clear Israel has a complicated relationship with Syria. I think it'd be their decision on how they treat that diplomatically. I do know that they haven't, at least in the current negotiations and discussions, on the chemical weapons strike issue on Congress, haven't officially taken a position on that. But in terms of opening to refugees. That'd be something that they'd have to decide they wanted to do. And I think they have a lot of other tensions as well in the region. But it's an issue worth considering. It's just not an issue that CARE gets involved in.
Here's an email from Derek. As a writer, I was in the camps around Reyhanlı, Turkey in April. The most constant complaint I heard was that the Free Syrian Army and other revolutionaries are constantly hijacking and stealing humanitarian aid within Syria. They also block the residents who live in under control of one faction to receive the aid when it suits their political and other purposes. It's also my impression that aid distribution is not accountable whatsoever, which is due to prevailing wartime conditions in Syria. Not only that a lot of it is being stolen, but it's also used for corruption of local officials.
Well, this is an issue. You know, when I mentioned the difficulty of getting humanitarian aid into conflict areas, this is something that's been going on for decades. You know, this happens around the world in terms of very difficult means to get aid. And a couple of years ago, this was an issue in Somalia as well. I would disagree with the premise that the aid is not accountable, but I would agree that it's very difficult to get in with warring factions. And that's a problem both with aid being stolen or diverted as well. I think that's always going to be a problem, and even more reason why the humanitarian organizations like CARE and UN agencies need to have unfettered access to address these people with life-saving assistance in a non, not taking a side, one side or the other in the political fight, but rather there to save lives.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed, as our guest earlier, Justin, was saying, the Istanbul-based journalist, that at some of the camps in Turkey, members of the Free Syrian Army have been trying to recruit people for their cause at some of these camps. Is that true as well in Jordan?
We haven't seen that, but we're not in the camp there. But I would say it probably is a consequence, as was mentioned earlier, of the lack of economic opportunities for these refugees. And so when you have a lot of people sitting around not being able to work and not being able to establish their livelihoods or continue their livelihoods that they had when they were in Syria, they are that much more vulnerable to things like that from both sides, I'm sure. But CARE has not seen that directly, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's happening, and it's even more reason why we need to try to find a political and diplomatic solution to end this crisis so these individuals can resume their livelihoods so they aren't vulnerable to being recruited to fight in this civil war.
You mentioned earlier, Blake, that you provide, among other things, psychosocial support, and I wonder what that means.
We do counseling and providing some health psychosocial support for a lot of the women that have come across the border into Jordan. When the refugees come across the border, often they're registered with the UNHCR into camps. But as I mentioned earlier, some of them get into the urban communities, and we have set up urban referral centers that are come about from word of mouth from others, and we provide psychosocial services for a lot of these individuals, whether it's counseling or giving them referrals to mental health facilities and others where they can get the assistance that they need. But one of the problems, of course, is you're looking at a country that's already has a significantly strained resources, and whether it's a school, a hospital, or other facilities, they're already in a difficult position trying to keep up with their existing needs in Jordan. And so that is obviously providing some tension in the communities.
For those of us who have never had to do this, it must be so incredibly hard to lose your home, right? To lose not only your home where you live, but to lose your country.
Yeah, I think that's something, you know, I think if when we think about how fortunate we are to live here in America, and you think about your home, I think it's really helpful to try to put yourself in the shoes of others. And so, you know, one of the things that I think can help address the humanitarian response to this crisis and many more around the world is to really put yourself in the shoes of some of these refugees fleeing their country. And just as you said, leaving their homes, you hear stories about individuals and families who had to flee in the middle of the night after a mortar attack. Mm-hmm. And often members of their family are killed, and, you know, they get there with less members of family than they came with, or with nothing but the shirts on their backs. And I think that empathy and trying to identify with those individuals will help in terms of addressing this crisis and this humanitarian disaster that's mm-hmm. happening in the region.
Yeah. Don has a number of questions. Pick up on what you'd like. Does Syria have money in the bank? How do they continue to fight and get those things for the continuation of this civil war without money? If this is a world crisis and there's such a large need for help, why doesn't the UN freeze those assets and use the money for helping the refugees? And if the world knows this is happening, where is the UN in taking action to stop it and to help those who have had their lives disrupted because of it?
Well, a couple of things on that. I mean, you know, we don't take a position in terms of the political conflict, although we say and we definitely push for a political and diplomatic solution to this. But that said, I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the UN is doing a lot with an appeal. They've asked for $4 billion to address the crisis in humanitarian aid. And while that's not all that money has not been secured, they're continuing to get more of that secured. And they have programs like the World Food Program and others that are incredibly important to that. And on the political side of things, as the caller or emailer probably well recognizes, that a lot of the difficulties can be trying to get a vote in the Security Council for some of the more political and issues. And so I think that's something that needs to be done through diplomatic channels. And we're seeing in the last day or so maybe some movement on that in terms of some of those political issues. But I think to say that the UN isn't doing things on that is not accurate. I'd say they're doing quite a bit, but the need is exceeding the funding that they have and the appeal that has been funded to date.
Are you encouraged by what's happened the last couple of days, that there may be a diplomatic solution?
Well, we'd like to see a diplomatic solution. I mean, from our position, any of the conflict's continuation only increases to the misery of the individuals suffering from this crisis. And so, you know, cautiously waiting to see how this plays out. But it's any of the conflict that continues can only increase the amount of refugees and those needing humanitarian assistance. And the sooner that a diplomatic and political solution and a lasting peace can be negotiated, the better off the Syrian people and those in the surrounding countries will be. And then we can address some of these other issues of underlying causes of poverty and help to reestablish their livelihoods.
Right. We started the hour talking about how this has been described as the world's worst refugee crisis since Rwanda. Would you agree with that? Do you want to put this in some historical perspective for us, Blake?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, especially as it continues and is increasing, when you look at, as I mentioned earlier, that you know, you're looking at nearly 2 million Syrians registered with the UN Commission on Refugees, and the scope of this, looking at $4 billion UN appeal, there's no question it rises to that level. And one of the difficulties is, we mentioned earlier that why hasn't this got as much attention? I think it is starting to get attention, but there's crisis around the world. CARE works in over 80 countries around the world, and just one example is in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where you have former Wisconsin Senator Feingold, a special representative to the Great Lakes region, where there's a lot of tension going on there and a significant humanitarian crisis there. So I think this definitely does rise to that level, but we also need to keep in mind this is not the only crisis on the map. And I think that was a previous argument for, well, how come people haven't paid attention to this, comparing it to Rwanda? But there's no question this deserves that attention. And unfortunately, there are other conflicts going on while this continues.
Mm-hmm. And it must be hard for organizations like yours when this crisis goes on and on and on to keep giving aid, to keep trying to help people reestablish their lives, and it's gone on for years.
That's exactly right. And that gets to the tension I raised earlier about the need to both provide immediate humanitarian assistance, but also look at the longer-term assistance to help support and secure livelihoods and how you can link those. And I think it's an interesting discussion to have. And I think in the last few years, USAID has moved forward with that, looking at both addressing immediate humanitarian crisis, but also longer-term livelihood issues. And this was brought up in the Horn of Africa crisis, which is, of course, another crisis a couple of years ago. That was brought up by natural causes, mostly by drought. But there are a lot of folks in need of immediate assistance. And then the longer-term importance of providing support for livelihoods so they can be less vulnerable during a protracted crisis, an upcoming crisis, which inevitably will happen.
So let's go back to those 12 people who are living in an urban apartment in Jordan. What are your hopes for being able to reestablish those people's lives? How are you working with them?
Well, I think from CARES perspective, our hopes is that they will be able to increase their assets in terms of being able to actively participate in their own livelihoods. And as I mentioned earlier, in the instance of the refugees in Jordan, unfortunately, they can't legally work currently. So are there ways to perhaps help support them through volunteer efforts with some of the humanitarian NGOs as one example? Or ultimately, our goal is for a peace to be negotiated so the conflict ends and they can return to their country and reestablish their livelihoods. But in the meantime, it's a difficult situation, and we can provide aid and hopefully a little bit towards ensuring that they can continue their livelihoods. For instance, if it's children, I would say ensuring that they are educated. You mentioned earlier that a lot of the kids are not educated, which is correct, and that's a big problem because once they lose that, then they get behind, and that's a significant, it'll significantly affect their livelihoods in the long term.
And if people are moved to make donations of some sort, what should they do?
Well, I think they can. There's plenty of NGOs out there. Without tooting our own, care.org, we do a lot of wonderful work. But there's groups we partner with. As I mentioned, there's the International Rescue Committee. There's Mercy Corps. There's all kinds of groups out there that are doing wonderful work. So I'd say look online in terms of some of the humanitarian groups that are out there. And if you feel inclined to support them, that's very much appreciated. And also just raising awareness with your member of Congress in terms of the importance of this, because in addition to NGOs that are doing support, we want to make sure the government continues to support these efforts.
And I'm just wondering if there's something that we need to hear about that the press has not alerted us to that you want everybody to know.
No, I'd say one of the biggest issues that we've tried to push, at least on the Jordanian side of things with the Syrian refugee crisis, is the urban refugees. And why that's important is that a lot of the money funded through the UN is done, is given through to directly to the camps. And we actually, CARE itself is about to help support a new camp in addition to the Zaatari camp that I mentioned earlier that has its fourth largest city in Jordan. But I think the awareness of these urban refugees is something that needs to be understood by the American public and hopefully their members of Congress representing them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that in turn that they can weigh in with their international partners.
Thank you, Blake, so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for the time.
Blake Zelzer, Senior Policy Advocate for CARE, a leading humanitarian organization fighting root causes of poverty all over the world. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks for your emails and calls. We have news coming up momentarily with the ever-changing political diplomatic solution, perhaps, to Syria. And Marvin Kalb is joining us the second hour of the program, a gentleman well worth listening to. He'll be talking about his new book, The Road to War. So please stay with us.